We the People.
We the People.
We the People of the United States.
We the People of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
In the summer of 1787, 55 men would gather in Philadelphia. They were tasked with fixing the government of the United States of America. Over the course of 4 months, they would debate, argue, refine and prepare the first document of its kind in the history of mankind, an attempt to prove that men can rule themselves by law. Over the next 3 years, the 13 United States would debate the ratification. This is the story of those men and of those times. It is a look at the ideas, the concepts, the debates, and the history of the Constitution of the United States. This is Constitution Thursday. As the convention prepares to adjourn for the Independence Day holiday, there is a great deal of anger and frustration in the room. Luther Martin expresses it best when he says that the convention hangs by no more than the width of a human hair. To move forward, a committee of 11 is chosen to come up with a compromise plan to present after the break. Dr. Benjamin Franklin will lead the committee, which is stacked with small state supporters. Can he get them to agree on a compromise that will please both the convention and the nation, which is waiting with great expectation to celebrate the Independence Day holiday? There will be speeches and fireworks from the nation expecting nothing less than success in forming the new government.
As the delegates looked around the room following the vote on Monday, July 2nd, a realization began to sink into them. This convention, this idea of saving, fixing, establishing a national government for the United States, was literally hanging by a thread. It was so close to just falling apart that many of the delegates were now openly talking about just leaving. There's nothing more that can, in fact, be done. Luther Martin, told you I would do that, expressed this repeatedly, and despite the fact that nobody liked him, and despite the fact that he was probably drunk and stank and spoke too long, expressed this very idea that everything was hanging by the thinnest of reeds at this point. The vote had really stunned everybody, and Washington's refusal to allow Daniel St. Thomas of Jennifer to tie Maryland's vote and take them out and thus give the big states a win sent a clear message, which was the small states are going to win this debate about the Senate. And despite the fact that Madison and Wilson, Gouverneur Morris and others, Hamilton, were adamant about having equal or proportional representation in the Senate, they were going to lose that battle. And that was clear as everything to anybody now. And the anger was just palpable in the air. The problem that the committee had, was that the day after tomorrow is the 4th of July. Now, to us, the 4th of July has become something of, I don't want to call it a minor holiday, but we certainly don't celebrate it as our forefathers did. We call it the 4th of July. We don't call it Independence Day. We call it the 4th of July holiday. We celebrate with barbecues and my personal favorite, baseball. I love the fact that I can watch baseball all day long. We rarely consider what the day actually means, because I think in some ways, with time and distance, we've kind of lost that meaning. One of my good friends down in Georgia, Betsy, always goes down to the local county courthouse on the morning of July 4th. And she stands there and publicly, for whoever will show up to listen, she'll read it out loud. I think that's a wonderful idea. I think we should do more of that. In 1787, the convention knew that the day after, at the end of today, we are going, July 2nd, we're going to adjourn for the July 4th holiday. And there are going to be celebrations. There are going to be dinners. There are going to be meetings. There are going to be speeches. There are going to be prayers, the likes of which we don't see today. They knew that there were going to be speeches being made by prominent Philadelphians who would extol the virtues of not just the nation, but of the committee and the convention going on as well. You see, despite the fact that it was quote-unquote secret, the proceedings were secret. The purpose of the gathering and the luminaries involved were well known to everyone. And so the assumption was, as Hamilton had pointed out a few days earlier about the prayer issue, the presumption was that these men were going to hammer out a government that would enable the United States to move forward. And there was no reasonable belief, no one thought, that these men could possibly fail at this. Imagine the pressure that that puts upon these men gathered in that room on Monday, July 2nd, after the small states have, by tying, just won a huge, major victory. They have forced the big states' hands. Where the small states were ready to walk if they had lost this vote, now maybe the big states are ready to walk because they're not going to get what they want either. And the fury in the room, I don't know that you can understand. I don't know that I can transmit to you the anger in that room at that moment. Mr. Sherman, we are now at a full stop. And he supposed we mean that we should break up without doing anything. Well, that's not doable, so let's do what we always do. Let's form a committee. Governor Morris thought the committee was an advisable idea because the convention had been equally divided. But he, too, had some secondary reasons. He didn't like the second branch of government, to be sure, and he wanted to defeat the object of it. But he also didn't like the Democratic branches of the state legislatures in the participation of that. And the Confederation Congress, changeableness in every department, excesses against personal liberty, private property, and personal safety, were the qualities that he was looking for to create checks and balances, abilities and virtues and equal necessary in both branches. Something more than is now wanted, he said. The checking branch must have a personal interest in checking the other branch. One interest must be opposed to another interest. Vices, as they exist, must be turned against one another. It must have great personal property. It must have the aristocratic spirit. It must love to lord through pride. He's talking about the second branch, the executive, as it were. He's talking about what he wants to see in a president, and he's concerned about how this president is going to be, this executive is going to be appointed. He wants someone who is rich, someone who has opposite interests of the people that are going to be electing the House of Representatives, and he wants someone who is prideful and boastful, and he thinks this committee is a great idea because, yeah, maybe we can force that. He also thinks it should be independent, and it should be for life. And so he thinks this committee is a great idea. Mr. Madison, of course, James Madison is dead set against this committee. He thinks committees are useless. He thinks they have virtually no other effect than to delay from actual work. You want to kill an idea? You want to kill a process? Well, just form a committee. It's kind of funny because of those of you that have ever read Yes, Prime Minister, or Yes, Minister, or Yes, Prime Minister, the great British BBC comedy satire of the 80s. This is one of the points that they make repeatedly. You want to kill an idea? Just form a committee. At the end of the day, when the committee reports, if the committee ever does meet and report, it'll just be a big whitewash. Eldridge Gerry was for the commitment. I always call him Gerry, but it's Jerry. Something must be done, he said, or we shall disappoint not only America, but the whole world. Remember the first day when Randolph was talking about all the problems we were having, all the difficulties we were facing around the world and in our entire Confederation because of all these problems with the Confederation, and now you're saying, well, we should just give up because we can't do it. It's too hard for us. Hello? We just beat the British Empire, the largest empire the world has ever known, surrendered to us. 13 colonies, 13 United States. Are we really saying that this is too hard for us to come up with a government that works? What becomes of our treaties? What becomes of our foreign debts? What of our domestic issues? We must make concessions on both sides, he said. Without these, the constitutions of the several states would never have been formed in the first place. So, they voted on whether or not to form the committee. 9 states voted yes. 2, New Jersey and Delaware, voted no. On the question of committing a member to from each state, 10 yes, Pennsylvania voted no. And the committee elected by ballot were as follows: Eldridge Gerry, Mr. Ellsworth, Mr. Yates, Mr. Patterson, Mr. Franklin, that's Benjamin Franklin, Mr. Bedford, Mr. Martin, Mr. Mason, Mr. Davies, Mr. Rutledge, and Mr. Baldwin. The convention, as Madison noted, had not chosen the most determined large state nationalists to be on that committee. In fact, Madison thought the committee had been intentionally stacked against the large states. That was not entirely true, but neither was it entirely untrue. This committee, which is going to meet starting tomorrow, July 3rd, and really meet for one day on July 3rd, is, while stacked in favor of the small states, is not a small state committee by any stretch of the imagination. There are issues yet to be ironed out. But sitting in that room will be Benjamin Franklin, who perhaps on July 3rd will make his greatest contribution of all. I mean, he made wonderful contributions to the Constitution, although very few of his ideas actually make it into this. In fact, Franklin is intriguing because he is actually more in favor of pure democracy than he is a Republican-type government. He's okay with this. He doesn't have a problem with it. But then keep in mind, he's a poor guy who made it big. He, at his heart and soul, he's, you know, Poor Richard's Almanac. He likes the idea of democracy. He likes the idea of equal representation. He likes all of these ideas. What he does not like is the idea that we might walk out of this room without a constitution at all. His position is very simple. Any constitution is better than no constitution. And he will make it his mission in life, as he has up to this point. He's entertained delegates at his home. He's had, if two states disagree, he has the state delegates from those two states at his house over the next night or two for dinner, where he will talk to them and encourage them. And it's noted that he tells jokes in the convention. He tells a joke that is apparently riotously funny. I think it's humorous. But apparently he tells it so well, about Scottish lawyers and the reason Scottish lawyers elevate their comrades to judgeships is to get them out of the way and to take over their law practice. If they're judges, they can't, you know, be lawyers. But he tells the story. It's noted by several of the members of the delegation that he is the best storyteller they have ever heard. He might be the best American storyteller until Abraham Lincoln comes along some years later. But he makes it his mission in life, and he's going to make it his mission tomorrow, to hammer out softly, not force people to acquiesce, but he's going to convince this committee to agree. Compromise is necessary, or we're going nowhere, and if we go nowhere, what are we going to do? Are we going to announce on July 4th, 1787, that the convention has broken up and no national government has been formed? Nobody wants this. Nobody wants that. But that's the level of the impasse that has been reached. Insults are flying off the walls. People are mad at each other. They're maintaining decorum, of course, because that's what they did in those days. They didn't argue the way we argue today. They didn't. Political discourse of 1787 was much different than it is today. But the insults were barbed and they were pointed. And there was a great deal of anger. And through all of this, Washington sits and watches and realizes that the day after tomorrow is 4th of July. It's Independence Day. And the entire nation is expecting this convention to not, as some would observe, not, well, he wants them to continue the American Revolution. Not the late war, the American Revolutionary War, but the ideal of the American Revolution, of liberty, of freedom. And they are dangerously close, as Luther Martin said, to just falling away. It's Constitution Thursday on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bowman Show. Adjourned at the close of business on the 2nd of July with the intention of reconvening on Thursday, July 5th, after the Independence Day holiday, which left the 3rd of July for this committee to sit down and kind of hammer through some things, as it were, come up with something to give to the convention to try and work their way through all of this thing. Dr. Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, who is, of course, an iconic American. Benjamin Franklin is one of those guys that he's so uncontroversial in our history that everybody virtually in America loves him, that or at least knows of him. Very few people think of Franklin and in a negative way. It's intriguing because the convention delegates didn't necessarily see him the same way. In fact, some noted that he was basically an old guy, old, short, and fat, and bald, with silly side locks on his hair, who didn't speak much, and when he did speak, it was pretty inconsequential, at least in the convention. In fact, virtually none of Franklin's ideas were accepted by the convention. One of the things that Franklin had wanted was that government officials of the United States government should not be paid. In other words, you should work for free. You should work for your nation. This idea was, if you were to propose that today, hey, government officials should not get paid, you would probably get thunderous applause depending on what audience you're speaking to. Upon sober consideration, however, people would start realizing, it's probably not going to work. And while Franklin's high-minded ideals of democracy and what the government should be and how it should operate were, I think, honest. I mean, this is what he really believed. The convention sort of looked at it as, that's not a good idea. He suggested, of course, the prayer before these sections. This was rejected, as we talked about last week, dramatically rejected. Hamilton's argument that if we start praying now before each session, people are going to find out and they're going to think they're going to think that this whole convention is falling apart and being held together by a thread. And even though that's the case, we don't want that. I kind of thought that the argument that they couldn't afford to pay one was probably more realistic, but you get Hamilton's point. The concern, and this is what I'm trying to drive to you today, is that there is a great deal of concern. The realization by these men that this convention is just about over. They've already opened the idea that some of the smaller states might go after foreign relations and interventions. They've already opened the idea of doing away with the states entirely. Many of the people there actually believe that that's the best way to proceed. There's these ideas that are shocking to us, Hamilton's idea that we should just crown a king. Governor Morris wants a president, an executive that's rich and powerful and anti-Congress. These ideas have all percolated up But all of these men know that in a day, you know, they're going to have a day off, but then on July 4th, they're expected to attend parties and speeches and services where, again, people are going to extol the virtues of this convention and talk about how wise and wonderful what they're doing is, and how the people of the United States can expect wonderful things soon from this convention. It's got to be a lot of pressure. Off they go into this convention, we're into this committee on July 3rd, where Benjamin Franklin is going to, as I said, perhaps have one of his most shining moments. The Franklin proposed a compromise in these words: if a proportional representation takes place, the small states contend that their liberties will be in danger. If an equality of votes is to be put in place, the large states say their money will be in danger. When a broad table is to be made and the edges of the planks do not fit, the artists take a little bit from both and makes a good joint. Franklin's use of language there is unfamiliar to us because we don't build tables today the way tables were built in 1780s. But his point is pretty clear. When you have two planks of a table that are trying to become a table and they don't fit together exactly right, you don't cut off one of them. You take a little bit from both. And the two joints then form one and you have a table. And his idea here is fleshed out amongst the men who are meeting there that day. His idea is very simply this. Okay, let's have proportional representation in the lower house, the House of Representatives, and we'll have equal representation in the Senate. And that'll sop the small states. The small states will go, okay, at least half of the government has equal representation. So far, so good. For the large states, who are concerned about the fact that the small states might be, you know, an equal representation, they're not getting proportional representation for their money or their taxes. Here's what we will do. All financial bills, all spending, all matters to do with finance will be handled, originated in the lower house by the House of Representatives, where there is proportional representation. This is kind of the genesis of that idea that we're going to see later on in Article 1, that all revenue bills commence in the House of Representatives. It's, to us, a no-brainer. We look at it and go, well, yeah, that makes sense. In fact, we argue about it today because sometimes we think the Senate starts revenue bills and they're not supposed to. And we get a little snitty about that, don't we? Well, in 1787, that wouldn't have been seen as the same kind of issue that it is today, at least not in the convention. In fact, the ideas of the convention are such that we've got to make this relationship work between these two sides. Now, this compromise that Franklin proposes is nothing new. In fact, it's the heart of the Connecticut Compromise. It's already been presented. But for the purposes of this committee, which has to come back to the convention with something on Friday and say, you know, look, or I'm sorry, on Thursday, and say, look, this is what we've agreed that we need to move forward with. The idea is agreed to in this committee. Not easily. There's some arguing, there's some debating, but it's Franklin and his gentle, humorous, look, we got to get this together because we can't go out of here without one passion that wins the day. And the committee adjourns, having decided that, yeah, all right, that's what we're going to present to the convention. The idea, the lower house initiates the spending bills, the upper house, the Senate, is in fact equal representation. How that equal representation will work out, we don't know. But this is what we're going to propose because we've got to move forward on something. And we can't continue to yell at each other and the likes of that. And so the committee disbands and goes their ways for the rest of the day. General Washington, you might think, you might wonder what he did on the 3rd of July, went for a horseback ride. Later, he would sit to have his portrait painted by Charles Wilson Peale. You've seen that painting, I'm sure. The Observer reported that while Mr. Peale and his sons worked at their easel and sketch pads, the general sat quietly, perhaps mulling over the crisis confounding the whole convention at that point. Imagine as you're sitting there getting painted. See, we go get our picture taken. We go to JCPenney or Sears or wherever, some photographer studio, and we sit and we get our picture painted. Or, I'm sorry, picture taken. It didn't work that way in 17. You had to sit still, and the artists wandered around you with easels and paint devices, and they sketched out what they were going to do. And it took hours. And all that time he's sitting there, he has time to think about what's going on in this convention and how can we move past this? What do we need to do? He's also very, very concerned. He's not happy that Alexander Hamilton has left. He's not pleased by this at all because he relies very deeply on Hamilton as a former aide and a former military assistant. He also, as we know by now, Washington is not openly, but certainly personally, he favors the big states and their idea of proportional representation. Washington feels that the states' rats people are demagogues and are hijacking the entire nation for their own selfish interests. All of this is going through his mind as he composes a letter, even as he's kind of sitting there, he sort of dictates a letter to Hamilton about why aren't you here? Where have you gone? What are you doing? Why? I need you here. Kind of approach to things. He's very direct, which is unusual. Washington had a way with words. He was very, very formal in his language. But he writes to Hamilton, I'm very sorry you went away. I wish you were back. Of course, Hamilton was upset. Hamilton wrote a letter back to Washington that quickly, I mean, Hamilton wasn't that far away, that the opportunity to rescue the United States from its current crisis might be lost if the convention fails. And the implication of Hamilton's reply is almost, I'm not really helping you. I can't accept this small state compromise. I can't agree to that. And so my presence there is hindering what has to happen. We have to form a government. Washington, of course, who probably feels personally much the same way, but understands the concept of duty, is perhaps a little bit, I don't know, wounded, perturbed, saddened by Hamilton's words, because again, to Washington, duty comes first. Duty to the nation comes first. And he maybe feels like Hamilton is putting that aside. Now, perhaps Hamilton looks at it differently, as in, I'm getting out of the way and letting this proceed, however it's going to proceed, and my presence there would be a distraction, but Washington doesn't necessarily see it that way. And so there's this bittersweet feeling amongst Washington where he's not happy about the fact that Hamilton is not there. He's not happy about the way things are going. He's not happy with the arguing and the debating in the convention. That night, the night of the 3rd, he will dine after he gets his picture painted with the at a restaurant or inn known as the Indian Queen. It's noted that he dines with some members of the convention. There's no notes of what happened. There's no discussion about what was said, but it's practically impossible that the convention was not the topic of discussion. Was Washington trying to ease over some ill feelings? Was he trying to gauge what the committee had come up with? Was he trying to plot where we go forward, how we move forward from here? All of these things had to be going through his head. As the sun went down on July 3rd, 1787, and as the convention members retired knowing that tomorrow was going to be, you know, it's a holiday, sure, but there's going to be a lot of work to be done because there's speeches to be had, there's beer to be drunk, there's meetings to be gone to, celebrations to be had. All, of course, in the hottest couple of days in Philadelphia in the entire year to celebrate the independence of the United States with the expectation that the American Revolution will continue and that the nation will be united under a central government. It's Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bowman Show. It's Constitution Thursday, back right after this. Independence Day, as it is properly known, not the 4th of July, is truly an American holiday. It is, well, it's the original American holiday, however you want to look at it. And it is perhaps a day which we have, I don't want to say we've lost the meaning of, but we certainly don't celebrate it the way our forefathers did in the 1780s and 90s, and even well into the early parts of this century. Families today, I mean, it's a summer holiday. It's a summer-themed holiday. We have a barbecue. We have outdoor cooking. We do those things. You know, it's a federal holiday. Everything's closed. Politicians make it a point to appear this day at public events such as parades. But they don't. We don't do things the way they did them in 1787. We don't party like it's 1787 anymore. Time was in that era that July 3rd, July Independence Day Eve, was really the focal point of celebration. July 4th itself would be reserved for more stoic discussions and readings and speeches and the likes of that. July 3rd, that evening, was considered the party, as it were. Raucous gatherings. They had bonfires. New England towns competed to build towering pyramids of barrels and caskets. Or, I'm sorry, casks. That wouldn't make any sense, would it? Caskets? No, they'd build them out of casks and barrels. Booze. Lit at nightfall to usher in the celebration. The highest, by the way, were found to be in Salem, Massachusetts. Guess where? On Gallows Hill, where the 13 women and 6 men were executed for witchcraft in 1692. They were composed as many as 40 tiers of barrels, and they were the tallest bonfires ever on record. The tradition flourished into the 19th and 20th centuries. Some towns still practice it today. We held fireworks, and we had salutes. A salute of one gun for each state in the United States is called a salute to the Union. It's fired on Independence Day at noon from any capable military base. And of course, some of the things that happened back in those days were different. Bristol, Rhode Island, held its parade that had started a couple years before that. 2 years before, in 1785, they held the first of their Independence Day parades. And it's to this day the oldest continuous Independence Day celebration. The ideals of the Declaration of Independence are so important and so ingrained in us that we, as a people in that era, felt the necessity to remind ourselves of what it is that we had done. I think there was an element of disbelief. I really do. I'm no psychologist. But I look at the era that was there, and the fact that they reminded themselves so often of the Declaration of Independence, I think that there was almost a sense of, did we really manage to pull this off? Did we really tell the King of England that we didn't like him and that we weren't going to worship him anymore or, you know, serve him anymore and then pull it off? Did we really do that? Yes, we did. And let's go through it all again. Let's tell the story again because it's a fantastic story. There were constant reminders of liberty. Now, this is a lecture that I don't want to get too far off on this again because we're talking about the 4th of July and Independence Day, but it's just a reminder that we weren't fighting for our freedom in 1776. We didn't declare our freedom. We weren't doing those things. We were fighting for liberty. Liberty and freedom are two different things, although they are slightly, and unfortunately today, commingled far more than they should be. Freedom comes from a high German word, Freiheit, which essentially meant that you had a unity of action. In other words, you could, but it implied in its usage, it implied an ability to do certain things. You were permitted to do things and go certain places and do certain things. Whereas liberty, of course, comes from the Latin, and its root meaning and the real meaning of liberty is self-determination. And when you combine the two together, because you have this unity idea in the German Freiheit and this independent idea in Libertas, you get e pluribus unum, out of many, one. So we have all these disparate peoples and ideas, and we're going to forge one nation out of them. The patriots were not fighting for freedom. They had that. What they didn't have was liberty. They did not have self-determination. And if you look at their writings of their day, and if you look even today at the Great Seal of the United States Army, you'll see an interesting thing in the middle of it. It's a stick, and it has a red hat on top of it. That's called a liberty pole with a liberty cap on top of it. We fought for liberty. I often define this in biblical terms in the story of Joseph when he was in the house of Potiphar. By the time he reached the height of his service with Potiphar, Joseph is a perfect example of the colonials under King George. They had freedom. They could go where they wanted to go. They could conduct business. They could, you know, do pretty much what they wanted to do. But what they didn't have was self-determination. They were still, in essence, slaves to the king. They were still under his thumb. And if the king decided at any moment to take away their freedoms, he could do so. Likewise, Joseph had Potiphar's trust, and he could do, go, sell, buy, whatever. But he did not have the liberty of self-determination. He could not of his own volition say, today I am going to go become this vizier of all Egypt. And Potiphar had him under his thumb. He could at any point take any of that away. That's the big difference between the two. And our forefathers really understood this idea. They understood liberty. They understood that liberty is not chaos. It is not every man doing what is right in his own eyes. They understood that there had to be an element of coming together, e pluribus unum, out of many one. They understood that. And the convention certainly understood those things because what they were trying to guard was the people's liberties, as well as establish a functioning national government that could not only function as a national government, but protect individual liberties and rights. And they were really concerned about this. And so as the 4th of July dawned, they found themselves doing some interesting things. George Washington actually went to a wax museum, believe it or not, there in Philadelphia. He went out and let people just kind of, well, he just kind of visited the wax museum, saw what was going on there. The entertainments of that day included, of course, parades, artillery salutes of 13 rounds times 3, church bells, fireworks. And a local newspaper wrote that the convention would provide, quote, a system of government adequate to the security and preservation of those rights which were promulgated by the ever-memorable Declaration of Independence, unquote. Can you imagine if you're part of this convention and it's hanging by a hair and you're reading that in the papers in Philadelphia on July 4th? You're kind of going, yeah, they don't realize how close we are, do they? General Washington, as I said, went to Dr. Chavat's Wax Museum. Pennsylvania officers drank 13 toasts, beginning with one to Congress, then one to the convention. Their second toast was to the convention. These guys are going to come up with a great government for us. We can't wait. They toasted Louis XVI of France. And they went all the way down to their list. You want to know what their last toast was? Their number 13 toast? It's kind of funny. They toasted to the state of Rhode Island that it might be excluded from the Union until they elect honest men to rule over them. even then, people didn't like Rhode Island. I've been to Rhode Island. I didn't really find it one way or the other, to be honest with you, but apparently they didn't like it much. The irony of the day, however, had to come at one of the speeches that was given. Now, there were several speeches. Dr. Benjamin Rush will give a speech, and he will extol the virtues of the convention as well as the Declaration of Independence. But we don't give speeches on Independence Day the way our forefathers did. It's something that I wonder if we're missing out on it. I really do. I would love to hear speeches about the Declaration of Independence and the greatness of America on Independence Day. I would love to hear those. I wish I could sit down for my show and just do an Independence Day speech about what the Declaration of Independence means both to me and my family and going forward. I wish if I'd had time and I'd been thinking about it, I would have invited people to come in. I would have said, you know, come in here and record your Independence Day speech. Let's share these speeches together. Let's go out on the courthouse and read the Declaration of Independence together. Let's do those things to celebrate and remind ourselves that we did once an amazing thing. And it wasn't going to the moon. It was getting the king of the most powerful empire the world had ever seen to bow his knee to us. One of the speeches was given, ironically, by a law student there in Philadelphia who was chosen, I guess, to give an exposition on the convention. And standing in front of some of the men, convention, we're told that General Washington went to this speech along with several other, many of the other convention delegates, because again, it was in Philadelphia. This young student asked this question or made this statement in his speech. Is the science of government so difficult that we have not men among us capable of unfolding its mysteries and binding our stars together? Here was a young lawyer, student, young law student, perhaps not old enough to have fought in the American Revolution, but having benefited from living now in a free nation, standing in front of the convention members, some of them, along with the elite, the gentry of Philadelphia on Independence Day, and asking a rhetorical question. Isn't it wonderful that we have men of such character and such capability that when they get done, we are going to have the government of governments binding our stars together forever? And can you imagine what goes through the mind of George Washington as he stands there listening to this? Can you imagine what goes through the minds of Luther Martin, who said that the convention is hanging by a hair? Can you imagine what Gunning Bedford, who has already said, perhaps we should go and look for a foreign aid because clearly these other states mean to ruin us. Madison, as he's writing down diligently, even the things he disagrees with, he writes down. None of this is known to this law student. He doesn't know any of this stuff going on at all. This is all out of his reach. But he has such faith in these men that he knows that when they're done, government that will bind our stars together forever will exist. What he doesn't know is that this entire convention is hanging by the breadth of a hair. And if Franklin's compromise doesn't work, the whole thing is going to collapse when they meet again on July 5th.
Constitution Thursday is a feature segment on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of The Dave Bowman Show, a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. Copyright MMXV. All rights reserved. For more information, log on to ConstitutionThursday.com.